Stealing Focus!
All right. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
So there is a reason why we have a cooler and Bud Lights, and that's because if it's good enough for Rodgers and Hammerstein, it's good enough for us.
Here at Stealing Focus, that is correct. We're talking about the latest rendition of Oklahoma on Broadway right now.
Yes, we went to New York last week, and we were able to see a preview performance of the limited run of the latest production of Oklahoma to come to Broadway. I don't think it's been on Broadway maybe for at least 20 years.
So I saw the Patrick Wilson version of it, which I think you said was had been in London.
So the 99 London production was revived on Broadway in 2002.
So it's been 17 years.
Almost 20 years. So it's a long time.
Yeah.
So this version of Oklahoma is very different. This is not your grandma's Oklahoma. This is the dirty, sexy Oklahoma. And so they are intentionally kind of stripping it down of everything you kind of equate with Oklahoma and kind of putting it at its core.
Yeah.
For those of us who do not know our musical theater history, Oklahoma is a very important show. It's the show that basically created the modern book musical. It's musicals before Oklahoma were very much song, shenanigans, song. Like, you could take the songs out and the plot will still make sense. It didn't further the story. They were kind of written to be hits. And Oklahoma was the first time where the songs were written in service of the book. They followed the story. If you take the songs out of Oklahoma, the story doesn't make sense, which is something we take for granted nowadays. That's what we assume, you know, that's kind of what we equate with a musical. Oh, it's using music to tell the story. But that is a very new thing once 1943 rolled around.
Mm.
And even then, a lot of old theater war horses like Irving Berlin and Cole Porter were like, what's this integrated musical stuff? This is ridiculous. It'll never fly. And so there were still kind of the old fashioned musicals being written when Oklahoma came around.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. People always scoff when they're like, oh, Oklahoma's so old fashioned. You know, how could it be revolutionary? But it was. And it also was one of the first musicals that used dance as a storytelling technique.
Hmm.
So Agnes DeMille created really iconic choreography, and she created the idea, of the dream ballet, telling story through dance in the middle of a musical. So these are all things we equate with Oklahoma. And, you know, the hit songs and the iconic score, and God, it's just so ubiquitous. You know, it's one of the most done shows by like high schools and regional theaters.
I think at
any given point, there's a production of Oklahoma going on at someplace in the country. So this production really tries to take everything you know about it and strips it away. It doesn't treat it as something sacred. It's like, just because a bunch of other productions have always done this doesn't mean we have to do it. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Overall though, I really enjoyed it because I'm very much of the mindset of like, let's burn the motherfucker to the ground. Let's tear it all down. Let's get rid of all our preconceptions and let's really find new ways to interpret this piece.
And I think that's a really good idea with any piece, with any work of art, especially musicals and plays. The text should be strong enough to stand on its own.
And
with
musicals,
new visions behind it.
Yeah, and musicals are fairly new in the history of theater.
Yeah.
And we do that with older stuff all the time. We do that with Greek plays. We do that with Shakespeare all the time.
Yeah. Don't change a word of it, and yet all the intentions can be changed.
Yeah, you find new ways to interpret it. And that's really what they did with this production.
Totally.
Okay, so let's talk about all the stuff they do differently. So first thing is it's at Circle in the Square, which puts it in the round. And it's very much meant to look like a barn dance. It looks like you're inside of a barn, really. And it's funny, I was I took pictures before the show and I sent them, you know, I posted a couple of them and I had a few people like on Twitter go, oh, it looks like a gym.
Yeah, it totally looked like a college production.
Except the thing is, if you were there up close, it didn't look like a gym. It looked right. like, it wasn't shiny enough to be a gym. It was like they had just drilled these things up and then, you know, just wood.
Yeah, just wood everywhere. Wood.
And there were gun racks all over the place. And there was like a 7-piece folk country combo on the stage.
Yeah.
You had your typical instruments, you know, you had the guitar and banjo and the upright bass, but they also had the lap steel, the pedal steel and a mandolin. So it was country all the way. I there might have been a keyboard, but I don't know. I don't know if there was. I think it might have been full-on country. The ensemble was really stripped down. There were 4 girls in the show, 4 female roles in the show.
Yeah.
There was Lori, Ado Annie, Aunt Eller, and Gertie, and that was it. And the guys were, there was something like maybe 5 or 6 guys in the show. So it was a really, really small version of Oklahoma. Like, you could have done it in a black box.
Yes. It was very interesting the way that they did it. So she mentioned it was at Circle in the Square, which is one of Broadway's smaller houses. It's in the round. It's a severe thrust, technically. So really, there's not a bad seat in the house. Anywhere you are, you can see just fine. The closest seats were actually at tables that were kind of
set up. Oh, yeah. So that's the other thing.
The dance, I guess, you're talking
about.
Well,
yeah. So, it was meant to look like a barn dance. And so there are tables on the stage, long tables with crock pots on them. And the characters in the show were, you know, when they talked about like their hampers, they would bring out some igloos.
They were
cracking Bud Lights throughout the whole show. They were like breaking up corn, throwing it in a pot during many a new day. And I guess at intermission, they were like serving the chili from the pots if you had those special seats.
Right.
The other thing was that the house lights were on for almost the whole show. It was
almost the whole first act.
Very minimal lighting in the show. And when it was done, it was very, very deliberate. So when the show started, the ensemble just walked out and then they're all sitting around.
Just lounging. Nonplussed.
At these tables, and then just Curly, when he's ready, starts singing a cappella.
Yeah.
All the orchestrations were incredibly stripped down and minimal. Mm-hmm. Some things were a cappella, some things were just... Curly played the guitar a lot. It was just as minimal as you could get, which was good.
Yeah.
They got rid... So I want to address the dancing in the show, because... choreography plays such a big part in Oklahoma, and they got rid of so much of it. Many a New Day is supposed to have a big dance break in it where the girls are all getting ready. None of that. Kansas City is supposed to have a big old tap dance afterwards where he's like, I learned this dance in Kansas City. None of that. They had Farmer and the Cowman, they danced because they were at the barn dance, so it made sense. And when they were singing Oklahoma, they were kind of doing a little dancing and stomping. But, like, that little sexy dance that the girls come in and do to Will during All or Nothing, it was all gone. Like, gone.
Hmm.
And then that leads us to the Dream Ballet, which was kind of the exact opposite of the original Dream Ballet. It was at the top of the second act, which was crazy. So the first act ends and Lori's singing Out of My Dreams, kind of a cappella, into a dream with you, blackout. And then it was like, all right, everyone, have some chili.
Yeah.
So we were like, oh, okay, I guess they're not doing the Dream Ballet. So then we come back for act 2 and there's this one dancer, I wanna see what her name is, Gabrielle Hamilton, and she was short and bald, and she had on a white shirt that said Dream Baby Dream.
And she
basically did the whole Dream Ballet herself. And instead of it being storytelling, it was interpretive. It was very modern.
Yeah.
The underscoring was crazy. It was, as far as I could tell, the complete dream ballet, but they, like, they've made it really dissonant at times.
They augmented it. It was very
And dark. Sped it up at times, like, made it really dark and weird.
It was disturbing.
And then sometimes it was really recognizable. The one thing I did notice is that they had her do the Agnes DeMille cowboy move. It's very iconic. It's like this, like you're riding a horse and you're kind of going from side to side and traveling the stage. And I'm curious if they did that as an homage or if it's because you have to do some Agnes DeMille choreography. It does the bare minimum.
Well, maybe it's both. Maybe it's a little bit of both.
Yeah.
But it was very, it was a really, really interesting interpretive dance, like you said, that really the audience could just take whatever they got from it.
Yeah.
It was very stylized, almost like it was off-Broadway. Oh, this did start off-Broadway, of course, but this
version. And I think she was supposed to be Laurie, just like in the original, you know, it's there's the dream Laurie. But she could have just been, she could have been anyone. I mean, like, it was so up for grabs. I mean, I think she's Laurie. She was the, there were some actors who came out during it who she kind of had moments with, but Laurie was the one, I think, she interacted
kind of
with
lingered
the most.
There.
What did you think of the dream ballet?
So yeah, it was at the top of Act Two. It was very interesting. I'm not as familiar, not nearly as familiar with the show as you are, but it seemed to me like total interpretive dance. Like I was at, you know, it was I was in college and I was watching some of my friends like just.
Yeah, but what did you think of it?
It was disturbing. It was there was parts of it that seemed joyful. There were parts of it that just seemed like when the music got augmented and kind of sounded demented a little bit. Like she got kind of frantic. There was a lot of frantic movement and it was clearly like sort of the struggle going on inside of her, you could say.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what the ballet originally is, kind of her torn between Judd and Curly and kind of seeing.
This felt like more of a societal thing, like struggling against, maybe it's just what I got from it, but it seemed like struggling against, I don't know, like the people that run the world, you know. It felt kind of like that to me, like an outcast or someone trying to survive in this world who doesn't feel like they belong, maybe. Something like that.
So so that was really interesting. They really play up the love triangle element, the Judd, Curly, Laurie, and depending on the production of Oklahoma. You know, I guess it depends, because in the movie, for example, I don't think there's a single moment where she's, like, turned on by Judd. Like, she's afraid of him the whole time.
Mm.
But then, you know, in the later revivals, they kind of hint that maybe there's something about him. But he's still always just this big, like, beefy kind of, looks like he could throw you around kind of guy. Big dumb, like, you too good for me, Laurie, kind of guy.
Yeah.
And this production goes completely the opposite. Like, for lack of a better comparison, they go very, like, Kylo Ren with him.
Yeah, he's very, like, emo, like,
but, like, I wouldn't
outcast.
Even say emo. He's like those edgelord boys on Twitter who are mad that ladies are in Star Wars, you know? He was, like, skinny and, like, fair-haired, like, sandy brown hair, and it was
like,
long.
Just like
he hair. Almost looked like Aaron Tveit, I thought. What was his name? So, and he was good, but, like, it was a totally different kind of Judd than I've seen before. Patrick Vale is his name.
And they did some really interesting things with cameras. There was like, we had a couple of scenes that were completely in blackout, which was
like,
really
not cool. Just like dim lighting, like
complete,
black.
Like a radio
pitch
play.
Black.
You're listening to a radio play.
All of
a
sudden you're
minutes.
Just like, well, my eyes are closed.
Yeah, and then it was a extreme close up on his face that was being projected on the wall.
Yeah, so this was it during the Poor Judd is Dead scene. And they start the song. They do the whole scene in pitch black.
Yeah.
It's like you could hang yourself. It'd be easy falling off a log or a chair. And then they
all
start singing "Poor Judd is Dead," and the lights come up kind of at the end, so you can see. So they're seated like this, like that, really close to each other.
Yeah.
And there's a camera. There's a guy with a camera like on Judd's face.
It's like extreme.
And it's projected
like, right?
on the wall behind them.
Yeah.
So during Poor Judd Is Dead, Curly's singing it and Judd's responding. But like you can see like Judd crying and getting all emotional.
Yeah.
The lights come up and you know, they continue the scene. And there's a lot of tension there.
Yeah.
And it's so funny, just as an aside, all these scenes that usually take a lot longer in this version, they are like boom, 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 boom. Because they cut out these dances.
And somebody cracks a Bud Light and they walk somewhere else and then another scene starts. It's like they're all just standing around. They're all sitting around.
But even the Poor Judd Is Dead scene, there's this dialogue before the song starts. And usually it's like I say a line and then Judd looks at Curly. And then Curly looks at him, and then they react, react, react. And because it was in the pitch black, it was like, you could kill yourself. I go, what? You could kill yourself. Easy as follows.
Yeah, yeah.
It was so
quick.
Oh, it
was clipping along.
So,
the whole thing was clipping along,
yeah.
Like you said.
So then, in the second act, when, you know, they're doing the auction for Lori's hamper, and Curly gets her, and then she dances off with Judd for a moment, and then there's this scene where Judd... Usually they have this thing where he gets kind of handsy with her and she's always like, ah, stop it, Judd, ah, you can. And then he's like screaming in her face and, you know, and then Lori's like, get Curly up. She's freaking out. So in this version, it goes black again. This time there's twinkle lights above because the barn dance lights are above, but you still can't see anything. And they have stage mics on, you know, like standing mics on the stage. And so I think they get them for certain moments. So they get it, and it's pitch black, and they're talking into the mic, and it's like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
I just wanted to get away from the group for a minute. And it's like, they have a couple lines, and then you hear them really loudly kissing. It's like, kiss, kiss, and then belt
buckle.
And then lights start coming up red, and Lori's on the fucking other side of the room. So I thought that was cool. Like she had a moment, that was a moment of like, oh, she's kind of into this. But then as soon as he starts like trying to, you know, unzips his pants,
yeah.
She's like, nope, nope, so much nope. And
and that's interesting that it was red, because in the first act, as Emily mentioned, the house lights were up almost the entire first act. There were only two moments where it went green. It was like a dark green.
Yeah, it went green when he was singing Surrey with the Fringe on Top to her. But just the last half, the sexy half. I can see the day getting older.
So we get green with Curly, then red with Judd.
Yeah. When was the other time that was green?
Pretty intense imagery. I don't remember, but I know it happened twice in the first act.
Yeah, so then...
Because it was the only time when it wasn't full house lights in the first act. It was crazy. It was like you're watching a show with no lights at all.
Yeah. And so... she fires him, and then she and Curly get together. And then that moment wasn't as triumphant as it usually feels she and Curly finally get together. Like everyone usually when that happens, you're like, yeah, like you're so ready for them to do it.
Right.
And like Curly is so happy and like they're so in love. And then they sing Let People Say We're In Love. And I don't know if it was because they just wanted to go darker with it or if they wanted to like feel the loss of Judd, but it was not as triumphant in that moment. Like she's like, I'll marry you if you want me to.
Yeah.
And but usually
like she was more scared of Judd than she was happy to be with Curly.
Yeah. And then Curly's response was like, okay, yeah, that sounds great. I gotta learn how to be a farmer now.
Yeah.
And then they sang People Say We're In Love, like a little cowboy duet, both sharing a microphone. And that was sweet. But, yeah, I felt like they didn't actually, like, I don't know, like that they were settling for each other.
Hmm.
And I think that was a conscious choice, but I don't know if I liked it.
Yeah.
I like that couple. You like that couple. You want to like Curly and Lori. They flirt and they're funny and, you know, they have a fun relationship. I want to get into this really cool thing, though. So the culmination of the Judd kind of love triangle thing. So spoiler alerts, because this is like really kind of different than the original production. Again, they don't change a single line of dialogue. So it's after they sing Oklahoma and they're all about to go, you know, I don't know, they're all about to party. And then Judd comes in, and it's like he's interrupting the party, and he just says, "I've come to kiss the bride." And usually in other productions, he comes in and he's like, "I've come to kiss the bride, I wanna get her." And they have like a big old fight, and then he falls on his knife. And so in this version, he says, "I wanna kiss the bride." He crosses over to her, he gives her a very sexy kiss. She and Curly are in their wedding whites, by the way. And then he walks over to Curly and gives him a gun. And then Curly tries to be like, "No." And then he's like, forcefully gives it to him. So then it's Curly and Lori standing there looking at Judd, and Judd, they're facing off with him.
So strange.
And then Judd takes, it's like suicide by, it's kind of like suicide by cop. He like, he gives him the gun, and then he stands there and takes one step to him so that, and then Curly shoots him. But they do this effect where it's on the stage, I saw. It's like something shoots up from the stage. Blood splatters on Lori and Curly.
Both white. They're wearing pink white, now they're spattered with the blood.
So then, the scene afterwards where it's like, let's have a fun little trial before they go off on their honeymoon in the living room. And they're all like, "He fell on his knife, it's okay, come on, you know, you wouldn't do this to this boy." But in this production, it was like, "You saw it, he fell on his knife. Didn't you see that, Cordelia? Well, come on, what are we going to do to the boy on his wedding night?" Yeah. Well, you all saw it. We're all witness. It was very much like we're covering like we're up here. A murder here. Yeah, and let's all make sure we're on the same page.
Yeah.
And don't you dare, we got the judge right here, so don't you dare, like, try to send Curly away. So that was really interesting. Again, no dialogue changed, just intentions changed.
Yeah, the direction of the intention is completely
and
changed.
And subtext. So that was interesting.
Yeah.
There
was just in general in the show, there's a lot of, there's a lot of intensity. There's a lot of intense stomping where it feels angry.
When they were doing Oklahoma, it was awesome. Really, they were going to town.
Yeah.
And it was cool to be.
It wasn't like joyful stomping though. It was
like letting it out.
Anger.
Yeah. It
frustration.
Was like primal.
Yeah, it felt primal. Absolutely. Similar to like the dream ballet at the beginning of Act Two.
Yeah.
I'm not sure like what was going on, at least subtextually. But what I took from it was...
Well, Oklahoma's... I think it's in the middle of the Dust Bowl, right?
Yeah. It felt like, based on what we're going through right now as a country in the United States, it felt very much connected to that, at least from what I took from it, which I thought was cool. There was a lot of... It was very intense and angry and...
I think it was like primal. I think it was like how people dance in like a mosh pit or like at a rave. It felt like dancing your cares away. It felt like we're gonna stomp this shit out and we're gonna like have a fucking ball. But it wasn't like starting with a farmer with a brand new, like it wasn't like that kind of joyful. But it was really neat to see, again, to have the house lights up, because that's the number where you could really see everyone in the audience singing along. Because everyone knows that song. I mean, it's just, and it's fun to sing along to. Like, everyone in the crowd was kind of doing little, like, kind of going like this. Like, that was kind of cool. Ally Stroker played Ado Annie, which was cool. If you haven't heard of her, she's a Broadway actress who happens to be in a wheelchair. She's been in a few shows. She was in Spring Awakening. So Ally Stroker, I've known of her for ages because she was in Ryan Scott Oliver's reading of Mrs. Sharp way, 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 way back, the first stage reading of it. And I remember Ryan being like, "She's really good in this part," and she's like, happens to be in a wheelchair. And I was like, "Oh, that's cool." And so she plays Ado Annie. And It's never a thing. She just happens to be in a wheelchair, which is great. And she's perfect for the part.
She was very, very funny.
Lori, it's so fun. They go against type with Lori. You know, Rebecca Jones is not like a Shirley Jones soprano. She's a person of color and she's very much like a different kind of contemporary rock pop singer. Yeah.
I mean, she could do a legit as well, but it's not something that she's done before.
Yeah, like not an obvious choice for Lori. And she was very much like in her jeans and like her flannel and like she's been working. And then I feel like with Ado Annie, they went in a different way because usually she's comedic musical theater belter, and she was that, but she had this kind of Dolly Parton thing going on.
Yeah.
With her voice.
Oh,
she had a lot of like, yo, yep, yep. Kind of things like saying that, like that kind of stuff, which made it sound a lot more country. She was like a little more like trailer trash than working on the farm. She had like little clips in her hair, and she was like just like the town floozy in her little pink shirt and cowboy boots. You know, she was very cute. And then the Curly was a lot more of that old 50s cowboy warbler. That there's a bright golden haze. Yeah, a lot of that.
Mm.
Surrey with a fringe. Like, almost like he was going to yodel any second.
Totally.
But I liked it. It was neat. That's how, what these Nashville singers would sound like in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Mary Testa was Aunt Eller, which is great. Aunt Eller, they usually, again, Aunt Eller's usually this like very old woman with like a little bun and a little dress, and she's like, oh, come on. Mary Testa's like, I don't know, she's like 50s maybe. Yeah. And she was just, you know, she was just in like, God, she was dressed kind of like a cowboy mom, like would it, like at Chico's, you know, she had like a denim dress with like a big chunky belt and like boots, you know. But she was very like matter of fact. She was a great Aunt Eller. She was perfect in the part. But she was just kind of a little more like hearty and younger and not quite so like, ah. So that was cool. And I felt the rest of the guys were pretty standard other than Judd and Curly. The Will was kind of like any Will Parker. He was good. The Allie Hackam was good. They didn't give him a goofy accent, which was nice.
Yeah. He had some really funny parts.
Yeah.
Like, that character always does, though.
And then, like, all the other characters are, like, in cowboy hats or those, like, kind of cheap, kind of trucker-y hats.
Yeah.
And I liked that. It looked like what Oklahoma looks like now. Like, what the people dress and look like there now.
Yeah,
not
absolutely.
Like when Oklahoma's supposed to take place.
No.
Which I thought was neat.
Yeah, it was a very contemporary take on it, for sure.
I think because of the let's make it dark element, there were a lot of parts that there are moments where I missed the heart of the show, I guess.
Yep.
And I understand that kind of had to be sacrificed.
Yeah.
To make it dark. But, you know, Aunt Eller has this speech at the end of the first, at the end of the second act, when Lori's like, I can't believe this just happened on my wedding day when Judd dies. And she gives this great speech to her where she's like, you gotta be hearty. And it's this really inspiring speech. And, you know, it's usually this wonderful moment of connection, and it kind of sends Lori off at the end. She's kind of like, okay, I can do it. And it was kind of just like Aunt Eller on one side going, you gotta do it. You gotta be hearty. You gotta,
everything is dead.
You gotta, the hardest thing in this world is you're living. You gotta do this thing, Lori. You gotta do it. And it was kind of like,
yeah.
I just wanted her to like hold her hand or something. And I felt that loss with Curly and Lori. Some of the transitions were weird because of the stripping down, because of the no music in between. There would kind of be a weird, awkward pause. But overall, I mean, I was never bored. I very much enjoyed it. I loved hearing these new interpretations of the songs. I loved hearing some of these lines in new ways.
Mm-hmm.
I feel
like every line was told in a new way. Like, as Emily was mentioning, direction, subtext, intention of lines, pauses, sarcasm was used, where you can take a line and not change it, but if you use sarcasm, you're saying the opposite of what
Testa's
the line is.
Yeah, Mary Testa's deadpan was pretty great.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, I really, really enjoyed all of those changes. I felt like, you know, why not? We've seen Oklahoma this done a certain way for years and years and years, since 43. And this is a very large departure from that, which is, I'm always down for that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's art, it should be evolving. And it can be reimagined in so many different ways. I had a little bit of a problem with the fact that the choice that they didn't use body mics, which you use in every Broadway house, any big house really, anywhere, you have to have body mics for singers, especially when the band's on stage. And although this band is minimal, it was a minimal band and very like stripped down, as Emily mentioned, and very folksy. You could almost get away with it at times, but when they would need to, they would use the mics, the hand mics that were set up like it was a barn dance.
Yeah, it had a very much a barn dance feel.
And there were just a few times when I was losing what people were saying because it was too hard to hear, especially when the music was going and they were talking, but they weren't near a mic.
Mm.
So I had a little bit of problem with the sound design. And the lighting design, although I thought used effectively, though stripped down, house lights on for the entirety, almost the entirety of the first act, full scenes in blackout like you're listening to a radio play, I thought that was very inventive and interesting. I sort of wish that it would have moved somewhere in the second act that kind of was a payoff for it.
Yeah,
I didn't feel the payoff.
Sometimes I felt like there was no point to it.
But I like the idea.
I'm torn on it because the two times they used it were during Judd scenes. So it had a purpose. And in the scene with poor Judd is dead, for example, they're supposed to be in his dingy little shack. Right. And
there's basically no set at all. It's just tables and chairs. That's it.
No, you're meant to... Yeah, they're supposed to be
minimalist.
Suggestions
you're meant
of
to
it.
Imagine it, right.
I think it was just... I guess it was jarring, but I think that's what they were going for.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard. Full house lights on the whole time can be difficult.
Yeah. So going back to this originated off Broadway last year. It wasn't even off Broadway. It was at Brooklyn St. Anne's Warehouse.
Yeah.
So at Bard College. So the director Daniel Fish had this intimate
for the 75th anniversary.
Yeah, intimate, immersive style set in a community hall, just like you said, with chili and cornbread served to the audience at intermission. So that definitely came across. I guess getting that from the beginning, as I mentioned before, I feel like if the payoff had come and there were a little bit more connections made in the second act where the story gets more important and the character involvement or the character relationships
I think
evolve,
that was it. I felt...
If that could have been a little stronger in the second act, I would have liked it
better. Yeah, I felt like Ado, Annie, and Will were pretty solid.
Yeah.
I felt their connections and I felt the fun love triangle on that front with Ally Hackham. There was something missing with Laurie and Curly, and that really sucks because they're supposed to be the heart of the show. That being said, I do like what they did with Judd. I think there's a
it's
way...
It's almost creepier, it's scarier, the way he played it than the typical big, lumbering guy.
That's what's like, scary was, now, was, though. He looked like the kind of guy who would shoot up a school. He really did.
Yeah.
Like, and that's what's scary to us now and frightening. And the fact that he was kind of sexy, like, makes it even more scary. So I think that was good.
Mm.
I really like the arrangements and with the music, with the orchestra. I can't wait to listen to them again. I hope they make a recording.
Yeah,
it says
new music arrangements by Daniel Kluger.
So
this version of Oklahoma is going till September 1st.
Okay.
So it is a limited engagement, like you mentioned earlier. I did not know that. I didn't realize it was limited engagement.
Yeah, I read that online.
So that's cool. I mean, that's a very... Limited engagements are... It creates a strong theater audience because all these New Yorkers and people in that sphere of influence up... all New England, all the theater people are going to want to go see it.
Yeah.
And it's smart to make it limited engagement because then... They know they have a certain amount of time that they have to get there. People are talking about it. It's getting all kinds of buzz in the theater community, as well as just the artistic community in general in New York. So.
The Gertie was great. She was fun. Just wanted to throw that out there.
What's her name?
Mallory Portnoy. She was great. Gertie, her laugh was a lot of fun.
Oh,
that's the whole thing with Gertie. She's supposed to have an annoying
laugh.
It was.
She only had like two scenes.
Oh yeah, Gertie doesn't have that much, but she's like a fun scene stealer part,
right.
And she pretty much had to like do all the heavy lifting for like all the other kind of one-off, one-line girl characters in the show.
Yeah.
Because they whittled down all the women parts because there aren't really that many.
Yeah. What would you say normally is in the ensemble? Like 20 people? Like normally.
Outside of the leads,
yeah.
I mean, it depends, I guess. If you're doing a high school production, you're going to have a cast of thousands.
Right.
If you're doing it on Broadway, I mean, yeah, there's usually a good ensemble.
Maybe 15 to 18 in the ensemble. So, yeah, this is a complete departure from that as well.
Yeah, I've never seen a production of Oklahoma that didn't have just a huge ensemble.
And that was pretty cool, too. Like, not just the music is normally big and brash and, like, very Heartland type. And to like whittle it down to sort of just like almost bluegrassy, folky, and then you whittle down the huge ensemble to just this really small. It's very compact, packs a punch. But I liked it. I liked how it completely reimagined the musical.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, the original production was innovative because it was telling a musical, it was telling a whole new kind of musical. It was making musicals completely different. It was reinventing the form of musical theater. But the show is still very musical theater. No one's singing like a country singer. Everyone's in big, beautiful gingham dresses.
They're singing Broadway
style. I mean, they do kind of like have like country-inspired songs, obviously, but like, and they throw in some southern accents, but you know, it's still Gordon McRae and Shirley Jones, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's musical theater. It was its own style. And then you get the 99 London production where they were the first production, for example, to be like, everything should be brown and gross because it's Oklahoma. And why is Lori in a gingham dress? She's working on the farm. She should be in overalls.
Right.
And that was the first time they had Lori do her own dream ballet. And then, you know, in Oregon, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, just like last year or 2 years ago, they did the production where they flip the genders around.
So cool.
And Curly was a black woman, and Ado Annie was Ado Andy, and Aunt Eller was a trans woman. And again, another production where they didn't change the text. All they changed were pronouns, and they got permission from R&H to do that. So, yeah. And this one did just as much weird stuff. The whole dream ballet was kind of like, wow, dude, that's crazy what they did with that. So they're obviously getting permission from Rodgers and Hammerstein to do all this stuff and to subvert it and to try new things with it. So I guess we'll see where this production takes us. I mean, I remember making jokes when I was younger, like, oh yeah, wouldn't it be fun to do Oklahoma in a black box? But now I'm kind of like, ooh, wouldn't it be fun to do Oklahoma in a black box? Because now you can.
Yeah.
Like, I'd love to sit down and do it with like a little country combo.
Totally. And like you said, it was adding that element of actual country sounding arrangements as well as vocals, like, was a big change, at least for me. And I really liked that. And as far as, you know, the touring possibility, it's hard to see because it's such a specific space.
I don't think they're gonna because
yeah, the circle and the square is very specific space.
Supposed to be a limited run in any case.
Right. So yeah, I don't know. In terms of being able to see it if you're not in New York, I guess that's tough, right?
Just listen to us.
It's not gonna come on the tour circuit because all these are proscenium stages. It wouldn't work. The only way that this production works is it's designed specifically to be in a very intimate space, like the public or like St. Anne's Warehouse or Circle in the Square.
So when you get the cast album, you can just watch our review and imagine.
Just imagine.
All of
you,
this
you
stuff.
Can just turn the lights out and listen to it all as if the whole thing is done in the dark.
But so if you're going to be in New York anytime through September, I guess.
September 1st.
I highly recommend you check this out.
Yep.
If you're one of those people who's like, in Oklahoma, I recommend you give it a try. You might see it from a new perspective. You might watch it and go, oh, I never knew that was actually funny, or I had forgotten about this, or XYZ. And if you have never seen Oklahoma, it would be an interesting first time to see it. I don't quite know what that
absolutely.
Would be like.
I mean, it felt that
way. If it would ruin you or if you would hate the show. Or,
it felt that way for me because I saw the Patrick Wilson version in 2002, so that was so long ago. That's the only time I've ever seen the show, so it's been a long time. There's tons of stuff I didn't remember, of course. I've never done the show. So I felt in a certain way that I was coming to it pretty fresh.
It's crazy.
But if you haven't seen it, all the better. You know, check this version out.
Yeah, so go check it out. Oklahoma is okay.
Thanks for listening to Stealing Focus.
You can find more musical reviews on our YouTube channel and Facebook page, and of course, more podcast episodes available on iTunes.